Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is April 14th, 2015, and my guest is Scott Sumner of Bentley University, and he is also the director of the Center for Monetary Policy at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. He blogs at Money Illusion and at EconLog, which, like Econ Talk, is part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. Scott, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Thanks for inviting me, Russ.
So we have a few topics I hope to get to today, but I want to start with one of your favorite themes, which I'll introduce with an observation of Nobel laureate Robert Shiller's. In a recent interview, he referred to what he called a puzzle of our time. And that puzzle is, why is there so little investment, either public or private, but he mentioned private in particular, given how low interest rates are? Because we think low interest rates should stimulate investment, and yet investment seems to be very stagnant and very low. So that seems to be a puzzle on his in his eyes, but in your eyes, and I would add in mine, it isn't a puzzle. So what mistake is he making?
Okay, he's doing what I call reasoning from a price change. And let me start off with an analogy from just basic supply and demand. Might make it easier to follow. So suppose I told you that I had a crystal ball and I knew that next year oil prices were going to be much higher than this year. Could you predict what the implications would be for consumption? Oil consumption from that fact. Now, a lot of people I talk to think, oh, economics tells us that if prices are high, people will consume less. But that's actually not the prediction of the supply and demand model. It depends on what causes the price to rise. So if oil prices are high because OPEC cuts production, then yes, people will consume less. However, if oil prices are high because demand shifts out, maybe the global economy is booming, then the higher oil prices will be accompanied by higher consumption. So it really depends on whether the supply or the demand curve shifts before you interpret what the impact of a price change is in general. It's just a common fallacy you see in the news media all the time. Now here with Shiller's example, he was sort of assuming that the reason for the, say, a low interest rates was something like maybe an easy money policy by the Fed. And if that was the cause, you might expect more investment to occur. But it's equally likely, and I would argue even more likely, that the cause of the low interest rates was a shift in the demand schedule. That is, firms were engaging in less investment, and as a result, there was less demand for credit. So interest rates are low, and there's less investment occurring in the economy. And that's perfectly consistent with supply and demand. Now, even worse, in some cases, when people from reason from a price change, they're usually right because they've identified which curve shifts most often. In this case, though, he got it exactly wrong. Typically, during low interest rate periods, investment is low, and during high interest rate periods, investment is high. And the reason for that is interest rates are strongly pro-cyclical. They go with the business cycle. So typically, in a recession, interest rates are very low. And in a boom period, interest rates are higher. And, of course, investment goes with the business cycle as well. So there's nothing surprising about low interest rates being accompanied by low levels of investment. It's what we usually observe in the economy.
So I want to come back to that. But before I want to come back to this particular example of interest rates. But I want to go back to your original point first, which is about supply and demand. And so I taught microeconomics for about 30 years. And I would always spend a number of classes, and there's quite a bit of material in my online resource on supply and demand, which we'll put a link up to, where I talk about different fallacies and mistakes that people make when using supply and demand. This is one of my favorites. It's to confuse a shift along a demand curve with the shift in the curve itself. This is a classic principles or intermediate micro or price theory kind of problem. So the example I use with my students would be the following. I'm not going to answer it, and we'll see if you can answer it in the comments if you want. Scott, you're not allowed to answer it either, okay?
Oh, okay.
So here's the question. Suppose if you see a new housing development that's being built near your neighborhood, should that depress you? It seems like it should, wouldn't it? Because it's an increase in supply, it would seem that would be followed by a reduction in prices, and that would mean that your house is going to be worth less than it would otherwise be worth because this new competition has come onto the market. So you have this piece of information. The information is that, and by the way, what I just said, if you look at it in the transcript, part of that is going to be true and false, and some of it's confusing, and some will be true some of the time. So I'm going to restate it now to make it a little more clear. If you see a new housing development going up and you're worried about the value of your own home, should this information that there's this new housing, should that make you happy or sad? And I think if you can answer that correctly, you understand something, I think, subtle about supply and demand. I want to give one other example. I used to get called by people in the media. They don't call me anymore because they're smart, but they used to ask me what I thought about some recent result in the value of the dollar, change in the value of the dollar. And they said, well, the dollar's rising or the dollar's falling. Is this good or bad for, you know, what's the implication for the economy? And I would always say, I have no idea, which is not a good answer if you want to get quoted. They were looking for something dramatic. But I'd always say it, that if you don't know the cause of the appreciation or depreciation of the currency, how would you have any idea of what the implications are for the U.S. economy? And this particular error of reasoning from a price change, to me, gets made constantly and probably every day in the media somewhere. People are opining about a change in the price of some currency. And to me, it's a perfect example of your mistake.
Let me give your listeners a perfect example. In the late 90s, the dollar strengthened because there was more demand for U.S. assets because we had a high-tech boom. Okay, that was a bullish sign for the economy. In late 2008, the dollar strengthened because monetary policy in the U.S. was too contractionary, in my view, which is also controversial. But anyway, that sort of strengthening, if it's due to tight money, is actually a bearish symbol for the economy. So it completely depends why the currency is strengthening. Same thing weakening. A currency can weaken because you're suffering economic collapse, or it can weaken due to an expansionary monetary policy like in Europe recently, which might be expected to boost growth in Europe.
Right.
So yeah, it's exactly right. It depends why the currency is changing. And that and interest rates are the two most common examples of where even professional economists tend to reason from price changes.
So let's go back to interest rates. And I wish Robert Shiller were here. What you're suggesting, because he may have a defense, I can't imagine it, but that's maybe a limitation of my imagination. But what you're effectively arguing is that the reason that interest rates are low is not because of an expansion of credit, but because of a reduction in demand. That is, at every interest rate, people want to invest less than they did before, and therefore that desire to invest less, the demand curve shifts down into the left, and the equilibrium interest rate falls, and the total amount of investment falls. And that's the end of the story, by the way. So there's the other mistake people make is they say, oh, but if interest rates are low, that pushes out demand and interest rates go back up.
An endless circle.
Yeah, which is not the way it works. There's a new equilibrium interest rate given the lesser desire that people have at every interest rate to invest. It takes a lower interest rate to clear the market than it did before. Why do you think there's a decrease in demand, and why are you content ruling out an expansion of credit? Because I think a lot of people, one thing maybe that Shiller would say is there's been a huge expansion of credit. And I guess another way to answer this question would be to ask the question is that are you confident that investment is lower? Because that would be the sign that the equilibrium has moved down into the left and not down into the right.
Yeah, and so that's obviously kind of a complicated question. I think there's likely more than one factor today. But if we sort of take it back from a few years, it's pretty clear what was going on in 2008, 9, and 10. During that period, when interest rates fell sharply close to zero, it was really weakness in the economy that was the main reason. So you had interest rates falling because nominal GDP growth was extremely low, even negative in 2009. And typically when that occurs, and you have a deep recession and falling inflation, you get lower interest rates. The same thing happened in the 1930s, for instance. But that's not necessarily the explanation for today. And I think that what's going on now is also reflecting sort of long-run global forces having to do with savings investment, which in my view are perhaps permanently or semi-permanently lowering the normal rate of interest in the economy. That is, the slowing population growth, the aging population, so on, is leading to less investment. Meanwhile, you have the rise of Asia, which is includes a lot of very high-saving countries. And so with these demographic changes, the savings investment imbalance, and this is something that Ben Bernanke did talk about, is probably lowering the normal interest rate even when the economy is not severely depressed. And I would say today the economy is actually not all that depressed, although it, you know, it depends how you measure and how, which variables you look at, but certainly not as depressed as it was 5 years ago.
Oh, that's for
so
sure.
The initial fall was the recession, and but now I think we're also seeing the impact of longer-term forces. I don't think it's due to what would be called an easy money policy, because if that were occurring, we'd see rising inflation, and we just don't see that.
Well, so, I'm gonna try to get you to clarify some of that, because that's what you just said. You said it was a complicated question, and you gave, a semi-complicated answer. One of the lessons as I was preparing for this interview, as I was thinking about the different things I wanted to ask you about, is that it is remarkable to me how complicated macroeconomics is generally, in that there are many, many factors changing at once, and we are all farmers. We're all picking cherries. We're all harvesters. We all pick cherries, and we pick the things that seem plausible to us, the stories or narratives that seem to make sense to us, and we leave out everything else. And you just made a list of a bunch of factors. I didn't think carefully while you were talking, but I suspect they don't all go in the same direction. Some do and some don't. We had all the factors we've mentioned so far. And then the question is, you know, what are the magnitudes? So to try to hone in, which of course we can't measure those magnitudes, but in terms of the impact of each separate variable, but let's try to hone in on some of these different factors. So you said, well, interest rates were low in, say, 2008 to 2011 because the economy wasn't doing very well, which means people are pessimistic about the future. They're not eager to invest, and that means that people are not eager to borrow money, and therefore you don't get very much for your money when you try to lend it. That's would be the argument. But then the economy bounced back quite a bit. As you said, you can debate how healthy it is right now. Why didn't interest rates go up? They haven't budged. They haven't budged. I guess depends how you define interest rates, but the short-term interest rate is still very, very, by historical standards, very low. Why didn't they go back up?
Yeah, and so it might help here to think about the way the economists approach the question. We sort of partition it into a couple different questions. One way we break it down is the distinction between the real and the nominal interest rate, where the nominal rate includes an inflation premium or adjustment. So back in the 1970s, when interest rates were very high, it was partly due to the high inflation that occurred.
Those were high. Those were high nominal rates.
Nominal term, right.
Meaning what we actually observe, and real is corrected for inflation. So go ahead.
Right. And so you can subtract out inflation from the nominal to get the real. Now, of course, in recent years, inflation has been fairly low. So that's one of the reasons that nominal rates are much lower than in earlier decades. But it's not the only reason. So the real interest rate has also fallen quite a bit. And that, I think, is the bigger puzzle, because economists used to think real interest rates were fairly stable at maybe around 2 or 3% on government bonds. And that's also fallen. So now when you look at the real interest rate, how do you explain that? And again, economists sort of partition it into two questions, a short run and a long run. They tend to think that in the short run, the Fed has some maneuverability to raise and lower real interest rates through monetary policy, but not as much flexibility as you might think, because there's costs of doing so. If you have an expansionary policy, you can temporarily lower real interest rates, but at a cost of higher inflation. If you have a contractionary policy, you can raise interest rates in the short run. But I would emphasize that these effects tend to be fairly short term, and the long term effects eventually kick in and you get going the other way. So in the 1960s, we had an easy money policy, but after a while, interest rates actually started rising because of the higher inflation. Now, a lot of people think we have a really easy money policy today, but I would argue that's kind of misleading because we're not seeing any of the macroeconomic indicators that would support that contention. That is, we're not seeing inflation going up. We're not seeing any sort of overheating in the economy that you would associate with monetary stimulus. So I think what's really going on is that monetary policy isn't as expansionary as it looks. It's more a defensive mechanism of the Fed injecting a lot of reserves into the banking system, and the banks just sit on them because interest rates are zero. But it's not having any stimulative effect. So I don't really think monetary policy is the factor that's holding down interest rates. If it were, I think you'd be seeing higher inflation coming along, and we're just not seeing that. Nor are we seeing forecasts of higher inflation going forward. So I'm just left with then back to classical economics, supply and demand. We apply supply and demand to the credit markets through a savings and investment schedule. More savings will lower interest rates. More investment will raise interest rates. And we seem to be going to a global economy where there's a lot of savings going on and not as much investment as we're used to. And as a result, those shifts in those schedules are pushing interest rates lower until they can find a new equilibrium.
Okay, I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to stop you there. I'm going to come back to the point about savings versus investment, because I think that's an important point. But I just want to backtrack a bit and talk a little bit about real interest rates, because I think you said something that might have confused some listeners. Mm-hmm. You said historically, economists used to, at least generally believed, and I think this is certainly true, that the real rate of interest, the productivity of the economy as a whole, is 2-3%. And then you said, well, you know, government treasury rates are about, you know, in that area. But I think that's a little bit misleading. I think because what you're really saying, the government sets an interest rate that'll allow it to be in the market and effectively borrow. Mm-hmm. But it's responding to the overall, the more general rate in the economy as a whole, which is a measure of the productivity of the economy. So when we say 2-3%, we usually believe that if you can put some money aside, there's usually something – an opportunity out there that'll let it grow at 2-3%, which would allow you to compensate your lender for the risk they took. And that some things will grow a lot faster than 2-3%. Some things will fail and be mistakes. But on average, the productivity of the economy is what allows there to be a positive interest rate, right? Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah. I wouldn't say it necessarily has to be just productivity. It's also about just economic growth in general. So you
Absolutely.
Can have like population growth.
Yep.
Australia typically is the highest population growth of the developed countries, and it's the highest interest rates of the developed countries. And, you know, a lot of people move to Australia. They have to borrow money to build homes there, to live there. And so that creates a demand for credit and supports a higher interest rate. If you think about the U.S., for instance, just think about the housing market. We're producing so many fewer houses than we used to. And all those houses we were building prior to the Great Recession, and even going back in the 90s and 80s, someone had to save the money to lend to people for mortgages to buy those homes, right? Well, now if we're building far fewer houses, then there's much less need for savings to support that activity. But if people are trying to save just as much, that savings just sort of floods into the credit markets and puts downward pressure on interest rates. So that would be maybe one concrete example I could give you of the forces pushing interest rates lower. There's just a lot less housing construction going on.
And that again, we're talking about real interest rates, the correct after correcting for what, and to be careful, we should say expected inflation. If I'm going to lend you $1,000, I'm going to lend you $100 and I expect to get back $103, and I'm pretty sure you're going to pay me back, so I asked for $103. If inflation's going to be positive over that year before you pay me back, I want more than $103, because otherwise I end up with less money in my pocket in terms of its purchasing power than when I started. So that's why nominal interest rates are affected by expected inflation. And of course, we don't really know what expected inflation is. We have actual inflation, and we often use that to adjust nominal interest rates and call the result a real interest rate. But it's not quite kosher, right? It's a little bit, it's a little slip there.
Yeah. Well, let me just also clarify one point. When you said you want to get a certain amount back to compensate you for inflation and to earn a real rate of return and so on, the question of what you want and the question of what you're willing to accept
yes.
are two radically different things.
And what you have to recently. And what you have to accept is
So if people are trying to save a lot and there's not a lot of investment activity going on in the developed world, and all this savings floods into the market, you could easily get interest rates going below zero as long as people are willing to accept that rather than the alternative. So they may be so anxious to save that they'll accept those low interest rates because they simply don't see any good alternative. Now, economists also used to believe that nominal rates could not fall below zero because everybody could hold cash as an alternative.
The alternative is to put it in your mattress.
Right, and you can always get zero rate of return on cash, risk-free. But now we've even found that isn't quite right. Interest rates have gone slightly negative in Europe, and it seems like the explanation is that people don't really like to hoard lots of cash, hold huge amounts of cash. So institutions in Europe that need to park $1 billion somewhere, they would rather take a slightly negative interest rate than to try to accumulate that much cash somewhere. Well, and so that's been a little bit of a surprise for us to see the rates go slightly negative. Now, we still believe they can't go very far negative because at some point people would switch over to just holding currency and putting it in safety deposit boxes. But we do see quite a willingness to tolerate low interest rates, especially in Europe and Japan today.
Yeah, I had a great uncle who, when he traveled, would carry money in grocery bags. Mm-hmm. I did not find that appealing as a young person. I remember looking at it and thinking, that's nuts. And similarly, if you have, say, a few $1,000, you're willing to pay to have somebody hold on to them in safety rather than leaving in your house where someone might stumble upon it and take it away from you. So we generally are willing to pay some sort of premium for the security of a bank's system, the banking system, whereas the mattress is really not – it's not risk-free, right? It's got
right.
The risk of theft, and that's definitely part of it.
Right. And so just to sort of summarize all this, if we break down the mystery of low interest rates into two parts, the nominal and the real, we can say that one part of it is easy to explain. We understand that inflation is a lot lower. Expected inflation is very low. We understand how this has been accomplished through better monetary policy since the 70s. And because we've got low inflation, we can expect lower nominal rates. The real mystery, as you indicated, is with the real interest rate, that's also lower than normal. And that doesn't seem to be as easy to explain. And that's where I've suggested these global forces of savings investment putting downward pressure on. But, you know, there's alternative explanations. Ben Bernanke has a new article that he refers to a decline in the risk premium. So people are willing to accept lower rates than they used to on like 10-year treasury bonds because they view them as being safer than in the 1970s. In the 70s, they had to worry a lot about inflation risk. So and also, they're the one safe asset in a world that's, you know, full of other types of risk like, you know, stock market and housing market fluctuations. So if you own treasury bonds, when everything else is going down, like in 2008 and 2009, treasury bonds are rising in value. So that makes them very attractive as a way of hedging risk. And so for all of these reasons, people seem to be willing to accept lower rates of return on treasury bonds than in the past. As I say, in the 1970s, they were viewed as a very risky investment to make because of the, you know, high inflation, high interest rates, and so on.
So your answer right now, which I'm going to challenge, your answer is that there's a lot of savings, which is pushing down rates, and there's also the possibility, which I don't agree with either. I have a problem with both these parts of the answer. So one part of the answer is that there's a lot of global savings, and the second part of the answer is there's a lot of there isn't a lot of optimism about the future. He didn't literally say this, but that's part of the reason potentially that the demand schedule for investment might be shifted in. It's that population growth is down. Opportunities in the future don't look as good as they used to. So here's the problem I have with it. I have two problems with it. First of all, if the savings glut, so-called savings glut, I hate that phrase. I don't think you like it either. But the increase in the enormous amounts of savings going on around the world looking for a return, if that was the reason that nominal interest rates were low, we'd expect there to be enormous amounts of investing going on as we slide down the demand schedule, as the credit pours into the market, the opportunities to use money pour into the market. Mm-hmm. That should result in lower nominal interest rates and lots of investing. We don't see it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case. I don't think the quantity of investing is up at all. I didn't look into it.
Yeah, you're right on that. And it's always a little hard to explain these things verbally because I always think in terms of graphs, and it's hard to do that verbally.
Draw away, Maestro.
If your listeners picture like a supply and demand diagram, but make the supply curve a savings schedule and make the demand curve the investment. So when interest rates go down, there's more demand for credit for investment purposes. So it's like a demand curve. Now, what's really going on, in my view, is both of these schedules are shifting, and the net effect is we're probably ending up with a little bit less investment and savings than before, but at much lower interest rates. Now, how could that occur? Well, if you draw it on a piece of paper, and if you shift that savings line to the right a little bit, but shift the investment line to the left by a larger amount, both of those shifts will put downward pressure on interest rates, but the net effect is
the net effect on quantity. The amount of investment.
You still have to go to an equilibrium point where the savings and investment schedules cross each other. And so this is what I think causes confusions when you just describe the process in words. If I say a savings glut, it sounds to most listeners like, oh, there's more savings than there is investment. No, in equilibrium, actually, savings will equal investment, as economists define these terms. But what has to happen is interest rates have to fall so low in order for that equilibrium to occur. Okay? In a supply and demand diagram, if there's a huge oil discovery, supply will shift to the right, but you don't have more oil than you are consuming. What will happen is the price will fall low enough until people will use that extra oil. And
moving down that demand curve, if that did not shift.
Moving down the demand curve. Now, in this case, I think the bigger effect is a shift in the investment schedule inward. Notice that the first country to hit low interest rates was Japan. They're kind of the opposite of Australia. They're a zero population growth country, very little demand for new housing and so on. In fact, falling population. And they were the first to hit the zero interest rate situation. And I think it's partly because there's just not a lot of good investment opportunities in a country whose population is falling fairly rapidly. So if you think of the investment schedule as shifting to the left, that puts you move down along that savings curve. There's actually less quantity of savings, and there's less actual investment occurring as well. But I think the savings schedule has also moved a little bit to the right. The net effect may still be for there to be less savings than investment, but the high propensity to save in Asia, which is a rising part of the global economy, I think is an issue here. And it probably was one factor undergirding the U.S. housing boom during the early 2000s. A lot of funds flowed into the U.S. market and financed mortgages and so on. And, you know, people even then, before the recession, were talking about the unusually low interest rates, given that the economy was booming. Remember, I think it was Greenspan that talked about a savings glut, or conundrum, that's right, a conundrum of low interest rates. And that was even before the Great Recession. So I think we've seen this process beginning to play out over a number of years, but since the recession, it's become much more noticeable.
Well, I'm pretty sure there's a three-letter word that we have not spoken much about, if at all, which is the Fed. Mm-hmm. And we are going to come to the Fed, but I think a lot of people tend to want to blame the Fed or honor the Fed for changes in interest rates. We're going to come to that, but I'm just telling listeners, and I also want to warn listeners that when you said a minute ago that lower interest rates should get more investment, you were talking about moving along a fixed demand curve. So you weren't making the fallacy of reasoning from a price change, which you had decried earlier. But as an economist, you just tend to take it assumed as given when you say that you were talking about a fixed curve and everything else held constant. I take the point about Japan. I want to come to the United States, and I want to raise a puzzle to that story you just told, which is the following. Mm-hmm. We both talked about how historically interest rates have been about 3% real. Mm-hmm. And usually people say 2% of that, 1% has been population growth. So as you point out, if your economy is pretty stagnant but you have population growth, you can have positive interest rates because there's more stuff going on, more activity. You can expand your business just because there are more people. But 2% of the three is growth, is productivity and technology and other things that are changing. So underneath all of this conversation so far, we've ignored an issue that has gotten a lot of attention lately, which is and we've talked about it here at Econ Talk a number of times, which is so-called secular stagnation. It's a bad phrase, by the way. Secular sometimes means non-religious, but here it means over time, which is confusing. But all it means really is that there's not much growth going on. We have a stagnant economy, supposedly. So here's my problem with that story. I look at a part of the country, California, that I visit in the summer, and there's just this unbelievable explosion of creativity there. And it's not just hypothetical. People are doing stuff, engineering things. A lot of it's software, obviously, but there's a lot of enormous opportunities for investment and a lot of wealthy people in the form of venture capital are investing, making bets, taking risk and investing in these firms. People are constantly – no one's sitting around saying, well, there's no point in thinking about the future because some population growth is low in America. People are not – they don't think that way. It's going like gangbusters. And there's a lot of investment going on in that part of the economy, the tech – so-called high-tech sector in Silicon Valley. How do you reconcile that fact with this story that you hear from other economists that – well, it's not going to be like it used to be when we had a lot of growth. It's going to be a sluggish. We've thought of all the good ideas for a while. You know, this is an idea. This is a theme. Tyler Cowen is somewhat associated with this. So is Robert Gordon at Northwestern. Other people who've said, you know, the glory days of the 60s and even some of the 70s and 80s, they're over. We just have to get used to this sluggish economy. And I look at Silicon Valley and I think, what the heck are they talking about? Is it everything else is negative and that's the only place where there's positive growth? Because that place is going crazy.
Right. And so that raises – and I've puzzled about this. I don't have any great answers, but I'll speculate a little bit on it anyway. One thing that I've noticed is that even though rates of return on government bonds are extremely low, it sort of seems like rates of return on riskier forms of capital are still pretty good. So investors in the stock market who have invested in these high-tech companies have been doing well. Of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, ex ante before the fact they knew they were going to earn high rates of return. But anyway, they've done pretty well. And then you've got a situation where government bonds are paying almost nothing as an interest rate. So investors are earning a pretty good rate of return on these higher-risk investments like high-tech companies. And I'm wondering, well, what's different from, say, the 1960s? If you think of the old economy that produced steel and cars and home appliances and things like that, if one company was making large profits, making, say, refrigerators, lots of other companies would start up essentially copying what they're doing and making refrigerators and hiring workers and putting together capital to make factories and so on. So it's a very highly competitive economy in that sense. A lot of the companies we see now in Silicon Valley that make large profits, it's not obvious how outside competitors would jump in and copy, eBay or Facebook or Google or, you know what I mean? Because a lot of these companies are basically based on certain forms of intellectual property, and this is protected by patents and copyrights and so on. So what you seem to have is sort of two parts of the economy, this thriving part, high-tech firms in places like Silicon Valley, but then a lot of the rest of the economy seems to be fairly sluggish and doesn't seem to be able to participate in that real high-charge growth that you're talking about in places like California. And it doesn't seem like those firms use enough capital to put much upward pressure on interest rates. Another thing that's sort of interesting about these new firms is they often have relatively small amounts of capital, of physical capital, and relatively small number of employees. So in stock market capitalization, they're very, very large. They're having a big effect on the high-tech sector, but they don't really require the enormous quantities of capital that the older economy used to need to manufacture basic items. And so it seems like the difference in the nature of the new economy might be one reason why growth in one area isn't sort of spilling over to the macro variables in the way that you might expect and as occurred in earlier decades. But that's just speculation on my part.
Well, that's interesting, though, and I think it forces you to think about how important these things are. One of the things that it also forces you to remember, which I meant to bring up earlier, is my Austrian side, is that we're talking about the interest rate as if there's a single rate. And of course, there's not. There's short-term rates, long-term rates. There's different kinds of risk associated with different kinds of savings and investment. And you make an excellent point that what's really different now compared to, say, 10 years ago or 20 to 30 years ago, there's two things that are different. One is, as you pointed out, inflation's lower. So there's no inflation premium right now built into the nominal interest rate because people aren't worried about it. But the second factor is that it's the risk-free rate that's low. It's the government bonds or you know, I don't know what the equivalent. There isn't an equivalent corporate bond, but it's that's low. And so as you point out, if you invest in certain types of sectors of the economy, or even if you just hold the S&P 500, you've made a lot of money over the last few years by putting money aside, a huge amount of money. The returns are extremely high. What's low is the short-term risk-free rate. And maybe we shouldn't be so worried or interested in that. Maybe that's we're spending too much time thinking and puzzling over that. And we should spend, although having said that, I'm not sure that the stock market returns are very comforting either. But the overall economy is growing. Parts of it are growing faster than others. And maybe it's not such an important or puzzling phenomenon that risk-free rates are low.
Yeah, and I could add one other thing. Someone could point out that the stock market returns may not be expected to continue at this rate, and you know that's certainly plausible. But we also have other indicators like the rate of corporate profits is pretty good. And people have been commenting recently on how a greater and greater share of corporate net worth is sort of in the intangible area, things that are not visible. Like it used to be more of the value of a corporation was in its actual physical buildings and factories and so on. But it's more and more in the intangible area today. And that also feeds into this idea that it may be related to intellectual property protections. It may be hard to compete away those earnings. And so even though you do observe existing firms making pretty good profits, at the margin, new firms entering may not be able to expect to earn nearly as high a return, and therefore you're not getting the investment that you normally would have expected when the corporate sector is doing so well.
I'm not sure. Let me push back on part of that because that's the part that caught my ear and I didn't agree with it. So here's the part I like. The part I agree with you with is that if you can make a slightly better washing machine or a slightly better car, the way that we normally saw progress – in the most of the 20th century was through technology, application technology to manufacturing. A lot of those gains, a lot of those have been taken advantage of already. And the future possible improvements there are relatively small. And so is the profitability. You make a market return if you make a good car or a good washing machine, but it's hard to make a killing. And if you did, it would probably be copied fairly quickly. Now, let's talk about the non-traditional, the new so-called new economy. Yes, there's Google and Facebook and all these iconic firms that make huge amounts of money. and they're protected by intellectual property rights. But there's so much possibility here for entry. You're not going to enter and grow into a firm that employs 250,000 people like a large manufacturer used to make, or 500,000 people, or even 1 million people. You're going to be small, but you're going to have a lot of capital. It's going to be human capital. It's not tangible. It can't be measured. But your productivity of your company, what allows you to get into the market and earn money, is really creative people coming up with a novel way to use a smartphone or something related to the web. And it seems to me that potentially that right now is just – it's enormous. It's not like it's hard to enter at all. People are doing it. Teenagers are doing it, and they do it well.
Some people are good at it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Let me
put it this way. I agree with you on one level, but I would say that a couple of things. The amount of capital that they're using in this process is often quite a bit less. So let's say that we've got two people that observe Google's enormous profitability. One of them is the CEO of U.S. Steel, and the other is a student at Stanford. Okay. And which of those two is going to say, oh, we should set up a new division sort of like Google so we can get in on those profits? The CEO of U.S. Steel is going to be probably very fatalistic, like, well, yeah, they're making a lot of money, but I have no idea how they did it. So even if I borrow a lot of money and set up a big research center in Silicon Valley, what expectation do I have that I'll make as much as Google? On the other hand, the student at Stanford might have some ideas that he or she could play out in a startup firm. But that sort of investment often doesn't actually require that much capital. So I think it's happening in a sort of a segment of our economy. The people with those skills, the creativity skills necessary to create those new firms, and they're doing very well, and they're pushing a lot of innovation, but it's not really having quite the macroeconomic impact that the broader industrial booms had in the earlier parts of the 20th century that really brought in the whole economy into the process, I think.
Yeah,
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. But there's a part that's not quite, I don't think, doesn't quite as, it's not as persuasive as it might sound. So, in the old days, if I wanted to, you're making the point that if I want to start a factory in Red River to make cars, I need a huge amount of money. But if I'm going to be tinkering in my bedroom with an app came up with, I don't need any capital. So that would argue that the demand for capital could be relatively low, even though there's a lot of investment going on. The problem with that is that in the old days, again, we're talking about sort of the old days, we're talking about this like it's the last 500 years. Really talking about 1945 to 1965, maybe, sort of the post-war steady, normal, somewhat staid economic picture of the post-war era, which was healthy until about maybe 1960-something, and then we started to get inflation, and then we started to get we got the malaise of the late 70s, and then we got the recovery of the 80s and 90s, et cetera. So we're about a relatively small period of U.S. economic history before the internet. But in that period, it wasn't like, oh, somebody said, oh, I'm going to start a car company. I'm going to need a lot of money. Most people couldn't start a car company. It was very hard to enter those markets. It's true that there was some competition across manufacturing companies. But the way you entered, it was mainly through, I guess, there was some expansion due to population growth and income growth, by the way, right? So there was an increased demand for cars. But it wasn't like we saw an explosion of entrance because they couldn't enter. It was too expensive and they weren't trustworthy. It's very, there were basically very few, zero, maybe one. And it was a niche car in the late half of the 20th century that had traditional manufacturing. I'm thinking about the McLaren or whatever it's called. I can't remember the name of it. I don't think it's the McLaren. But and yet, so it's not obvious to me the fact that the traditional economic activity was more, quote, capital intensive, and I would call it brick and mortar capital intensive. Most of the capital expansion, I would assume, in the, say, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and even 80s, it was things like somebody builds a grocery store on the corner, CVS, Walgreens suddenly comes up with this idea that they can make a national pharmacy brand. Starbucks comes along. They're building on every corner. These are not giant capital projects, right? Now, it's true that they're smaller – excuse me, that they're larger than creating an app on an iPhone. But again, you know, if I'm making an app, a serious app, not just a little fool around thing, I got to hire people. People are expensive. They require – I have to borrow money from those venture – I not borrow money. I have to give up an ownership stake. Those venture capital firms, they invest a lot of money. It's not a small amount of money. So it's just not obvious to me that this claim that because the new economy doesn't hire as many people, doesn't invest as much brick and mortar, there's so much more of it. It's not obvious that that doesn't overcome some of the differences in the physical economy in the old traditional ways.
Yeah. I would say, though, even on the question of entry, even though maybe it was hard for an average person to, say, enter the auto industry, I do think the old manufacturing economy was closer to what economists call perfect competition. For instance, the products they sold, the price tended to be fairly closely related to the cost of production. So there was enough competition among the firms that were already in those industries, like, say, automobile industry, so that if the car sold for $20,000, it might cost $16,000 or $18,000 to make, something like that. In the high-tech economy, you have many, many goods for which they sell at a certain price, and the cost of manufacturing is almost zero. Now, normally, when that is the case, you would have just tremendous competition. Firms would jump in at the chance, but in a lot of cases, either there's intellectual property protection, so one firm has a patent on a certain type of software or something, or there's something like, say, network effects, where one company is dominant because everybody wants to be using the service that others are using. That's sort of the Facebook effect, the eBay effect, and things like that. So I think there's something different about the high-tech economy. I'm not sure exactly which of these characteristics is crucial for what we're talking about, but I don't think it's really quite the same as the old economy in terms of competitiveness, if you will.
I agree. I mean, I think it's probably more Schumpeterian. If you go back and read, which I haven't in a while, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy – in the Capitalism part of that book, the first section, he really has some deep and probably very relevant things to today's economy where he talks about – basically says, you know, the goal is not to be like everybody else. The goal is to be a monopolist and hope you can sustain that long enough to make some money. And you're right. In a way, you can sustain it longer today than you could in the past, possibly. And again, I don't know if that's anything to worry about, but I just don't know if that has anything to do with interest rates. That's all. I think these are really deep and important and interesting things, and there are no answers. There's no obvious answer that's right about whether these differences are important. But it's not obvious to me that interest rates, real interest rates, should be lower in a virtual economy that has more virtual firms and more software development than it has hardware development. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Well, to change the topic slightly, I would also go back to the notion that my view, which is a little bit different from many others, is that interest rates mostly reflect market forces over any sort of reasonable period of time. So, you know, on a day-to-day basis, the Fed may be setting interest rates, but over any longer period of time, they basically have to be reflecting market forces. If they weren't, you'd get an explosion of hyperinflation or deflation. The economy would become highly unstable. And since we're not seeing that, we have to assume that the place where the Fed seems to be setting interest rates must be relatively close to an equilibrium interest rate. Otherwise, we would be seeing some signs of strong disequilibrium in the market, which we're just not seeing in the macroeconomy.
So
something is causing it that is, in my view, not what would be considered artificial. And a lot of the people I debate on this say, well, interest rates are just being artificially held at this level, and this isn't the correct level. But this is the level where the market has them. And no one's been able to convince me that the Fed is a magician that can make interest rates be vastly different from their equilibrium level and hold them there for many, many years without any sort of inflation or deflation side effects cropping up.
Which is unfortunate because I like to blame the Fed, as many people do. You know, One of the things that disturbs me about the current world, and this is irrational, I suppose, but it bothers me that my children are growing up in a time when the return to setting money aside for the future is close to zero. So when you say to them, oh, you know, you could save some money and don't have to buy everything with the money you have, their response, which is correct, is, well, what's the point? They look at their savings accounts, they're getting pennies, and it's like it's a fool's game.
And let's think about how strange that observation is. You're absolutely right, but just to drive home the point of how strange that is, this worry that people have, you and many others, is occurring at exactly the same time that Thomas Piketty has become famous making exactly the opposite claim, that the capitalists are doing better and better and, you know, the workers are doing worse and worse. So Piketty's claim is that the returns to the savers are too high and they're worsening wealth inequality in the global economy. So, and that gets back to this dichotomy we drew between the safe assets, like treasury bonds that have very low rates of return, or bank accounts, ordinary bank accounts, and these riskier assets, like corporate stocks or real estate. You know, rents are very high, landlords are doing well. And that's a little bit of a mystery, how these things are coexisting. And why aren't the people that are investing in the risky or the safe assets, why aren't they moving their money into these stocks or real estate investment trusts or things that offer higher rates of return?
Well, one answer is it's hard to do when you're 15 years old,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah,
for my son...
For that example, but, you know, there's also a lot of fairly, you know, affluent people that have money in accounts that are in relatively low rates of return.
Well, let me put myself in that class for a moment.
Uh-huh.
And restate your question a different way. We talked earlier that the stock market's done very well. You pointed out there's no reason it may not be sustainable. I'm kind of anxious that it may not be sustainable. I have a lot of my wealth tied up in the S&P 500 and various assets like it, but that's probably the biggest one. And I'm pretty confident that it's not going to continue to look that bright. So I'm thinking, you know, I should reduce the share of my savings that's in the stock market. But of course, the question then is, and put it in what? Put it in a treasury at a few percent that I might get eaten up by inflation? I can protect it against inflation. There's treasury protected securities, but they don't pay very well right now. It's interesting to me how there's nothing in between, is the way I would describe it. There's the risk-free, which pays close to zero. It's just a little better than your mattress. Then you have the risky, which is very unclear what it's going to happen. It's not going to likely be a steady 10% or 8% or 6% up over the next 10 years. It's going to have some wild possible swings. So that to me is what's weird about and unpleasant about the current environment.
Yeah, well, I guess all I can tell you is you can obviously, you know, spread your risk by doing some of each in some proportion, but and that gives you sort of an intermediate level of risk and an intermediate level of return from one extreme or the other. But getting back to Piketty, it is interesting that he talks about the return to capital overall as being so high, and you know that just seems to. It seems strange that we're having both of these conversations at the same time. Conversation about capitalists doing so much better than workers, and then this conversation about people that save earning such low rates of return on their savings. Obviously, I think you've identified what the crux of the problem is, these different types of investments. But nevertheless, I do find it kind of interesting.
Well, actually, you identified it, and you also made the distinguishing point, which I think is very relevant. And other people are starting to notice this also, that a lot of this is being driven by housing. So in the corporate investment world, stocks, bonds, et cetera, there's a lot of risk and there's been a lot of there's a lot of unpredictability about it going forward, right? Rates, it's been a great stretch for the last few years, but most people are not so optimistic that the future's going to be anything close to that rosy. Similarly, if you bought a house in 1995 in the right place – by 2005, 2007, you had made a huge return. But if you bought it in 2007 or 2008, you haven't done so well. It's not so attractive. And I mean, if I could do one thing to change, I don't know how to phrase this, the idea that your house is where you should be parking your wealth, to me, strikes me as a very bad idea for that idea to be widely held.
Yeah, but I'd like to point out something else about housing that's kind of interesting. So there's this perception that housing was really overbuilt in the U.S. During the housing boom.
Yep.
And, you know, that's certainly true in some locations, but the data doesn't really tend to support that. Rents have been rising actually fairly rapidly in recent decades, so faster than people's incomes in many cases. And people that invest in rental apartments, I think, have done very, very well in recent years. And one of the reasons for that is that there's a lot of restrictions on building now, so building since 2008 has been at very, very low levels, and yet the population continues to grow. So people are going more and more into rental units. They're having difficulties getting mortgages. And so that part of the real estate sector, rental units, is doing very well, and rents are rising. And in many of the most prosperous parts of the country, you can actually argue that there's too little housing because of regulations that make it difficult to build. And so that pushes up prices and rents in those areas. So again, we have a market that's kind of complex, and I think the story that people focused on a few years ago was the overbuilding in certain locations, but nationwide you could argue that we actually aren't building enough housing, and as a result, the costs are going up, which means the returns to landlords in New York City and California and so on are actually very high right now.
And homeowners generally, right?
Yeah, they get an implicit, you know,
right,
rent on the so, and they may profit if the price of their home goes up in those areas.
Yeah, which they have dramatically in many of them. And you raise a great point, which is this: the restriction on supply part of this story. It depresses me greatly when people say things like, "Oh, you know, we need to build some low income housing in such a city, or we need to have more opportunities for the middle class to have comfortable places to live." Well, in New York, in any city, again, take the two places that I'll take the three that I have some acquaintance with, and New York, Washington, and California. These are three places where it's very expensive to live if you're a young person starting out in your life and you'd like to either own a house or just rent an apartment. And the question is, why? Because it wasn't always – people say things, well, California has great weather. Well, it had great weather in 1962. New York's a great city. It was a great city in 1960. It had some issues, yes. But why is it that as these places have grown in their attractiveness, the mix of housing has, I suspect, moved greatly toward the high end? And that, I think, is due to regulation. And it's a terrible result. And capitalism gets blamed for markets get blamed. Oh, the market just doesn't produce low-income housing or middle-income. It only produces high-end. Well, there's a reason for that. There's a reason that that's so profitable. You have to jump.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that a lot of people on the left don't fully realize how much of some of the issues they worry about is actually driven by regulation. One is inequality, I'm working on an article on that topic right now, but also this investment question we were looking at may be part of it as well. I mean, it's just a lot harder to get approval for all sorts of building projects. One is housing, as we've been talking about, but even things that people on the left tend to favor, you know, government projects like high-speed rail, and in Massachusetts they fought endlessly to build a wind farm off the coast. Well, these days, these get tied up in the courts forever, and it's very hard to get a project actually built, a major, like, infrastructure project of that sort. So because of the increasing complexity of regulation and land restrictions, environmental rules, and so on, it's just harder for us to have the sort of economy we had in the 1960s, where we just build highways and housing developments all across the country whenever there was a demand for it in a certain location. And, you know, there are costs of that. One is there's less investment in the economy. I would argue it worsens inequality in a number of ways as well. It's hurting renters right now relative to homeowners. So, but that's something I think people on the left don't fully recognize when they think about the effects of regulation. They don't think about the connection with inequality. Another thing, for instance, is that a regulation often makes it harder for smaller firms. There's sort of a huge amount of fixed cost of complying with all these complex government regulations that come along. And as those regulations get more and more burdensome, they're easier for bigger firms to deal with. And studies show that there's more inequality at large firms than small firms, for instance. So that's another way in which regulation could be increasing inequality.
Well, that's a nice story, and I'm sympathetic to it, of course. I just don't know if it's true. And you have to think about what evidence would allow you to – you know, I've heard the claim made before, and it's plausible that regulations have gotten more complex, more burdensome. But I think the challenge is quantifying that in a way that's credible. So here's an example. I was just in Israel for 2 weeks. Israel's they have security issues, of course, but on the domestic side, the thing people are most worried about is the price of food and housing. There have been protests in the street. Netanyahu was almost lost this last election because of his failure to do anything about it, and he's made lots of pledges he's going to fix it. But the reason that there's a food and housing crisis in Israel is pretty straightforward. There's a lot of barriers to importing food and to creating retailing and food, so food's really expensive. There are cartels, literally, in some parts of the food supply that keep the price higher and growing. And that's easily fixed if you wanted to, but politically it may be very difficult. And with housing, the government owns a lot of the housing, a lot of the land in Israel. And to the extent that it doesn't, it makes it hard to use it privately. So recently I was talking to a guy who's building a house. He said it's going to take 3.5 years. When I told that story to somebody else, they laughed. They said, oh, he thinks it's going to take 3.5 years. Now, when it takes maybe half a decade to build a house, you can be pretty confident that rental prices could be pretty high in a growing economy, which is your point. And one way to quantify that would be to try to see how much longer it takes to build a house in Israel today than, say, 10 or 20 years ago. I don't know if it's changed. It may have gotten a little bit shorter, but in the face of growing demand, it may be offset by that. And similar in the United States, when we talk about regulation in real estate, which is enormous in major urban areas, I'd like to see some measures. How long does it take? How many bureaucracies do you have to go through? Now, we're still much better than Israel, but I'd say we're probably in the ballpark. Maybe it's not the 3.5 year thing to build a house, but I assume if you want to start a real estate development in New York, it's a major political investment. And as you say, that rewards high-end large firms. And of course, if you're going to have to incur a large fixed cost, you're probably going to tend to build on the higher end. So I assume that's part of the problem, but it's a story. I'd like to see some evidence.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of evidence that the cost is large. One piece is that in places like Los Angeles, if you have, say, a 10,000 square foot piece of land that is zoned for 2 units rather than 1 unit, it's worth vastly more money in the marketplace. And so that gives you a pretty good estimate of what that particular zoning rule, if it is only zoned for 1 unit, it tells you that zoning rule is costing quite a bit of money, in the hundreds of thousands, let's say.
Yeah,
and by the way, another area where regulation increases inequality is some of the increased copyright protections. So copyright laws have gotten stricter and stricter. Part of this is under lobbying pressure from companies like Disney so they can, protect Mickey Mouse for 100 years. And so, consumers pay more for Mickey Mouse toys and Disney makes more money, and that's due to regulation.
Yeah, I guess
it's something people don't think about often when they using the term regulation, but it is an artificial barrier to entry for new firms.
Yeah.
And copyright used to be just, I think, 14 years, and it's been extended much, much longer with recent legislation.
Yeah, I think that's a mistake, but I don't think, again, it's probably hampered somewhat innovation, but again, I see lots of innovation going on. I think the bigger challenge is this issue we're talking about, which is real estate and the cost of renting or the return to homeowners who already own homes and their ability to use the political process to protect those investments seems to me to be a really big problem that doesn't get enough attention.
I agree.
My guest today has been Scott Sumner. Scott, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.